This episode is brought to you by Wild Alaska Pollock, the fish of the future. Learn more and try a free sample at wildakpollock.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey there, you are listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. I am one of your hosts, Amanda Dell.
I'm your other host, Kimberly Chow.
Food Book Fair is a festival of writing about eating. We've done events in New York, in Los Angeles. We hold book signings and we do other programming in and around the world of food media. And we are, as I mentioned, your hosts of Recommended Reading, our show on Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to Heritage, where we get to chat with some of our favorite friends and fam in our community and hear what they're reading, watching, and listening to, and talk about what their latest projects are and what keeps them up at night.
We're happy to be coming to you live from this hashtag Giving Tuesday. And the headquarters of this beautiful nonprofit radio station. So go to heritageradionetwork.org to support the show and many others. It's going to be my first plug for the day. But Amanda and I are going to chat, and then we're going to welcome the chef, Edouard Massy. We're really excited to have him on.
Woo!
Born in Lebanon. He's based now in New York.
Thank you, Matt.
He was recently back in Lebanon for the olive oil harvest. He is an avid reader. We'll have him come on to talk about recent pop-ups he's done, other stuff he's doing, and, you know, what he's consuming these days. But first, Amanda.
Yes.
What are you reading, watching, and listening to?
You made it sound so like I'm reading, watching, and listening to a lot of things all the time.
I think I am. We are.
Yes. Yeah.
You got that screen time counter on your iPhone.
I know what it
tells me every week.
I wish.
Oh, don't turn it on. It's going to scare you.
My computer is like attached to my hip. I actually watched something on my actual TV the other day and I was like, whoa, what is this television thing? Like I sat in my living room and watched it and I was like, this is weird, but I'm into it. Well, I will start with the sad one, though important one, and then I'll get to something a little happier. We have talked many times on this show about The Daily, the New York Times daily podcast. It's usually about 20, 25 minutes, gets released every morning with an accompanying story summarizing what The Daily podcast that day is about. It's hosted by Michael Barbera. And the one that was about 2 days ago was about a fulfillment center in Memphis, Tennessee, where they did an interview with a former employee of this center. And we also talk a lot about Amazon. This isn't an Amazon fulfillment center. It's another separate company called XP that is used by many companies, including like Nike, Verizon, to fulfill online orders.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a really harrowing recounting of a woman's experience working at this fulfillment center.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get into too much of it. Some really sad events happened, you know, while she worked there. And it really kind of opened my eyes to, thinking, you know, about the rest of the country. Like I really feel like I'm very much focused kind of on what's going on in New York and, you know, what the kind of jobs there are here and what kind of opportunities there are. And, you know, she basically said, if you want to make decent money working in a fulfillment center is if you don't have a college education is really your only bet.
Mm.
So I really encourage everyone to listen to that. Long story short is that after the actual podcast was over, Michael, I will refer to him on a first name basis because I love him, said that 8 senators actually wrote a letter to this warehouse demanding that they undergo a private investigation of the working conditions, mm-hmm. and that they want to bring forth new legislation, mm-hmm. all based on the New York Times reporting. Mm. So while as sad as it was, I was like, wow, this, the New York Times is just extremely powerful, and journalism is really powerful, and it can start to, change things. Mm-hmm. So I would highly recommend that episode. Mm-hmm. On a more interesting and happier note, I also, my love for New York Magazine. This is not about The Cut, though. It's about Vulture, which is the culture vertical, where they discuss television shows and movies. There was, an interesting article written by Aaron Sorkin about Aaron Sorkin adapting To Kill a Mockingbird for the stage, which
was
I guess
it,
now...
Was it in the first person?
Yeah. He was recounting the story of this is actually going to be a little personal. I think why I really liked this article was because, how can I say this diplomatically? When I used to work in restaurants, a producer named Scott Rudin would often be a guest at a restaurant that I worked. So Scott Rudin is the producer of this play.
Oh.
And he's a huge, huge, huge Hollywood producer and worked with many people. And Aaron was saying that Scott called him up and was guess what? It's so exciting. We're going to get to do the play. What do you think? And Aaron was great, I'm in. And so then he submitted the first go to Scott. And Aaron was saying usually when they've worked together in this capacity, when Scott does his first review of it, he it's 2 days. Mm-hmm. And they're just working on it nonstop. And he said in the first review or first pass that Scott wanted to do with what he submitted for To Kill a Mockingbird, the meeting was 45 minutes. And so he was just there's 2 things you need to change about the play, this and this. And then it took Aaron another 9 months to write. Mm. So if you're into theater and you like To Kill a Mockingbird, read that on New York Magazine's Vulture. Mm. All right, that's my semi-deep dive into what has been open on my computer lately. Kim?
I just remembered that I need to listen to the new Mariah Carey album, Caution, which I hear slaps.
I listened to it while cooking.
Edward is nodding at me really hard across the room.
I listened to it while cooking for Thanksgiving.
Okay, cool.
And it has a really fun sample. Now I forget. Oh, I know what song it is.
What is it?
It's, now I forget who sings it. It's I know you saw me on the video. True. I know you saw me. Yeah. Okay. But you still won't give me no attention. Okay, so she samples that.
Okay.
Which is probably a sample from something else.
Nice job, Amanda.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm trying to styling.
It was he was really short. Okay. He was a rapper that was, he was in the P. Diddy family.
Okay. All right.
If that's what he's calling himself these days.
I think it's just Diddy.
Diddy. Yeah, right. Diddy, okay. Yeah. Drop the P. Got it. Okay.
Caution is on my to listen list. I have been listening to a lot of the Spotify's new release radar, and it's a lot of top 40 music, but sometimes things will come into my queue and I'm I should look into this.
Oh, I never click on that.
Oh. Yeah. I've spent a lot of time recently in Detroit, so that means I drive a lot. And I just listen to Hot 97. And I listen to the pop radio stations. But this is a little bit ahead of that. But Mariah's on my list. I am reading, I'm toward the end of You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine by Alexandra Kleeman, which is weird as shit and super deep and really, really good. It's about 3 characters, one named A, who's the narrator, her roommate, B, who is trying to become her, and her boyfriend, C.
A, B, and C.
Yes.
Gotcha.
but it's basically a missing person story told from the point of view of a missing person. But don't know that. And that's not a spoiler either. It came out a couple of years ago. It's awesome. I got it from my favorite bookstore in my neighborhood called Unnameable Books on Vanderbilt in Prospect Heights. And I'm happy to give them my money or my store credit anytime. And this is a great find. And I've been devouring it since this weekend. And then I just read Allison P. Davis's profile of Lena Dunham in New York Magazine as well. I think Allison P. Davis might have topped Taffy Broadusser Achner in the canon of great celebrity profile writers.
The one thing the one thing I will say, as you know how avid of a reader of The Cut I am, I think they changed the headline. Like, I saw it one day and the headline was something else.
Well, there is do you mean, were you looking on mobile or were you looking on web? No, because you know they changed, there's like different things to get different people to click.
How can we get someone from The Cut to come
I don't think it would
show?
Be that hard.
Okay, let's do it. Anyway, I skimmed it basically. So tell me a little more about it.
I did not. It was a hard and long read, but it's revealing as to her and her artistic practice and also our society. I can recommend reading it. It's if you did not, I mean, I don't know. I had a hard time watching Girls sometimes, and I also had a similar feeling about this profile. But I think Allison P. Davis is an incredible writer. And a great reporter. And that's partly why I read these stories. So that's on my list.
Cool. Well, there was something else on my list, but I think I'm going to save it for Edward because he had it on his list too.
Maybe you can both talk about it.
Yeah, should we dive in?
Yeah.
Edward Massey, welcome to the show.
Hello.
This is recommended
officially
reading.
Welcome.
Thank you.
We recommend a lot of weird things, but things that weird and great. Okay, are you sure you want me to do it?
Yeah.
Okay, so I was just going to recommend our friend Rebecca Pepler's new book, Aperitif, Cocktail Hour the French Way, just came out. It's the perfect size. And also I made the Kier cocktail in here for Thanksgiving. And it was a hit. I mean, really anything I would serve my family, they would pretty much drink. So they're not exactly the most discerning sippers for the most part, but they really enjoyed it, and I'm really looking forward to making something from the snack section.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Yeah, so it's just a really...
The charcuterie cone?
Mm. Oh, I didn't see the cone.
Yeah, that one's fun.
Oh, you did it already?
I mean, I just looked at everything. I did not make it, but it's fun.
Oh, I see
like the way
she
did that.
I see the cone.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool, because then it's like handheld, and you can pass it around or
isn't that
whatever
brilliant?
It's great for like
to
an hors d'oeuvre party.
Yeah, all food should be in cones. I mean, wait, I take that back, because I've seen like pizza cones and stuff, which I disagree with.
Cool. Well, I think it's like a great holiday gift, and also if you have it already, like pull it out if you are doing something for holiday.
I know she just did an event at Now Serving in LA, which is one of our favorite bookstores in the world.
Yes.
Great culinary bookstore, partner of ours for Food Book Fair LA, and I know they have signed copies there. And they're just a great destination for your holiday gifting, so check them out.
Yeah.
So you're reading that. Yeah. What else are you reading?
You
brought some of your own recommends.
Yes. I brought The Jeweled Table, which is probably one of my new favorite Middle Eastern, Armenian, Lebanese cookbook. Mm-hmm. And this publisher has been doing a lot of Middle Eastern books, and I'm really, really into them. Mm-hmm. They also came out with a new book called Sukkar, which is sugar in Arabic, and they have all different type of desserts. And what I liked about that book is that it makes it... Middle Eastern desserts are very difficult to make, and they kind of make it easier for the modern chef, which I really like.
What are some of the tips and tricks?
Yeah, what contributes to the desserts being hard or harder?
Well, there's like so much work with phyllo.
I see.
And, you know, phyllo is very difficult, so they kind of talk about using pastry dough instead of phyllo dough, which kind of makes things a lot easier. And we use a lot of syrup, like rose water syrup and orange blossom syrup, and which kind of can get very heavy. And they kind of go away from that and just like drizzle it at the end or finish off with it instead of soaking everything in the syrup, which makes things like sticky and harder. So yeah.
Cool. That's a good recommendation.
Yeah, this book looks absolutely beautiful.
I know, they're beautiful. And what I like is that they're taking a lot of pictures in Lebanon and bringing it all in together, which I really enjoy, instead of just pictures of food.
Cool.
Yeah.
Shout out Hardy Grant Publishers for looking out.
Yeah, that looks like the kind of book that you would, like, we say has a good huggability factor. Something that you... Oh, are you gonna sorry.
Am I gonna? Am I gonna?
To,
yeah.
To huggability. JJ?
Huggability is a quality that we attribute to the cookbook writer JJ Good. Whether the cookbook has utility, you could use it, or you just want to read it in bed, like at night under the covers, and a physical book has huggability.
Yeah. Okay. So that looks like
huggability and appeal.
Yeah. High on the huggability scale.
And I like that they have the pomegranate on the front of the book because
it's like an illustration.
Yeah. And I just recently learned it has something to do with like the Armenian life, like genocide, because when they were walking over to Turkey, they would get pomegranates and they would have them in their pockets and they would eat one seed a day, and that's what kept them alive.
Wow.
And I just went to a family friend's house for Thanksgiving and they're Armenian and they had pomegranates all over the house, and I was like, what is up with the pomegranates? I mean, I love them, but why are they everywhere? And then they explained that to me and I was like, oh my god, it makes so much sense why it's on the cover of the jeweled table.
Wow.
Yeah.
And who is the author of the jeweled table?
Bethany Keddie. Okay. Which I don't know her very well, but I do like her recipes.
I think this is a UK edition.
I think so. I definitely think so. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some people that believe that when they speak of like the biblical story of Adam and Eve, that the apple is really actually a pomegranate. Oh. There's kind of like some history to kind of like substantiate that theory.
Wow. I like that.
Of, you know, because that's kind of like apples maybe wouldn't have been there, but pomegranates.
What have?
Right. Mm. Mm.
Which kind of makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the story of Persephone eating the
seven
pomegranate seeds when she's in the underworld.
And then she grows the babies, right? Yes. Is that what happens?
No.
Oh.
Because.
I think she.
I got to look this up under the commercial break. But she. Maybe there's like the part two to it. The part that I am most familiar with is when she's in the underworld and is the bride of the king of the underworld. The only thing she eats is seven pomegranate seeds. Or six pomegranate seeds, which represents the times of year when the earth is dark.
Huh. Oh, okay.
I did not know that.
Me either.
Wow, that was like a really bad telling of like,
I need to get back into my Dallaire's book of Greek myth.
I think it's a transcultural myth.
Got it.
But it's a way, the daughter of Demeter. Wow, I'm pretty sure I'm getting this all wrong. Somebody like get the vaudeville cane and drag me off stage. but what else is on your on your reading list?
Well,
listening list, or
I just finished reading Boy Race before watching the movie, which was amazing.
Did you see the movie also?
I did. Oh yes, I did. It was a great movie. I think obviously the book is much better, but the movie was very captivating, and I think that Nicole Kidman did an amazing job as the mother.
The book is a memoir.
Yes.
And then the film, it's about someone's experience.
Yes.
Going to what is the
conversion,
term?
Conversion camp. Yes. And he's born and raised in Arkansas, but goes to Alabama to the conversion camp. And
close.
It's close,
basically.
Right? Yeah, basically.
Basically.
And the mom has a big role in the movie. So does the dad as well. Mm-hmm. But the mom has a big role because she brings him there and stays with him throughout the whole time. Mm. And the author is actually now, he lives in Brooklyn and is a professor at Brooklyn College.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
What is the author's name? Remind us.
I totally forgot. But I will look that up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. You saw the film also?
Yes, I saw the film as well. And I'm also, so I just finished that up, and then I've been reading Becoming by Michelle Obama.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh my God, is that actually out?
Yes, it's been out.
Oh, she's on tour.
Oh, she's doing everything, yeah.
Yeah, she's out there.
Oh, right. You know what? I read the profile of her stylist, the one that she used to work with from like Ikram in Chicago or something like that, who now lives in Brooklyn. Who doesn't live in Brooklyn?
Ikram Goldman lives in Brooklyn?
No, not Ikram. There was a younger woman that was working there that then became like her stylist and probably is helping her with this book. Oh my God, I gotta read this.
Yeah, I'm just breaking into it. I'm like 60 pages in. But what I really like about it is that she's not just talking about her life. She's also talking about what's happening around her, like the timing and the setting and what's happening in American history. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes the book makes it like you understand things much better, which I really like. I don't really know much about American history that much, so it's really like nice to hear it from her point of view.
How long do you think the checkout queue is on New York Public Library if I go on there to try to reserve that book? Like, it's like I could get it like next year
I don't know. Maybe this is something you should look into.
I'm going to. I was like, well, I don't want to buy it on Amazon, but I could go to a bookstore.
You
but
could go
I
to could your go to, favorite independent bookstore.
I know. But I also...
Or you can also support our great public resource, the library.
Exactly. But it will probably take me a couple months to get it. So.
Yeah.
All the decisions definitely. I have to make.
You can look it up during the commercial break.
We have a lot to look up during the commercial break. Yeah. We need to know the author of Boy Erased. We need to know a very, very brief history of a Greek myth.
Greek myth.
And I will check out the queue in the library. So we do have to take a quick break because we got to play some commercials because we are on Heritage Radio Network, which is a non-for-profit radio station, and we need to get some money so that we can keep these microphones hot. In addition to going to heritageradionetwork.org and pledging your support there, you can also come to our super, super fun fundraising party called Winter in the Garden. It's at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. Wait, is that true? Yes, it is.
Yes.
It's at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. It is coming up very soon, this coming Monday, December 3rd. So there's tons of info about it on heritageradionetwork.org. So find a way to support and just do it, as they say. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wild Alaska Pollock, the fish of the future. Wild Alaska Pollock is incredibly delicious, highly nutritious, and perpetually sustainable. Among the last frontier's many natural wonders, Wild Alaska Pollock just might be the state's best-kept secret. This cousin to cod has lean, snowy white meat, delicate texture, and a mild flavor that makes it extremely versatile and tasty. Only pollock caught in Alaskan waters by U.S. fishermen can be labeled Wild Alaska Pollock. Unlike other pollock products, Wild Alaska Pollock is filleted and frozen just once within hours of being caught to preserve freshness, flavor, and texture. And now, food service professionals can try Wild Alaska Pollock for free. Request your sample at wildakpollock.com and discover the fish of the future. That's wildakpollock.com.
Hello, you are listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. We're back.
Hello, is it me you're looking for? Yes, you found us.
You found us. It's Kim.
And Amanda.
And Edward Messi.
Woohoo! Yeah, we're coming in strong with some good recommends. Yeah. So he is back with us.
We looked up a couple things over the commercial break, though. We needed to find out how many pomegranate seeds did Persephone eat in the underworld? I'm still not sure, but it sounds like it. The curse was that the world would stay dark, and she would stay in the underworld with Hades between one third
Hades
between one third and one half of the year.
Wow!
So that's fall and winter. So yeah. When she's above ground, it's spring summer.
Wow, I'm gonna really do a deep dive into some of those myths. They're
I'm on
so
like
interesting
mythologywiki.com. So I might have to look somewhere else. But we also found out some higher numbers than than five or six pomegranate seeds.
So thanks Matt, our engineer here at Heritage Radio Network. He's always
looking out
for us and will sometimes supply us with some sound effects, so we appreciate that. He looked up how many holds there were at the New York City Public Library System for the Michelle Obama new book. It's called Becoming Michelle, right? No, Becoming.
It's just called Becoming.
Just Becoming. Becoming. Okay. 695 holds are currently on that book. So I will figure out another way to get it.
We love you, Michelle.
But yeah, the library, like I love it. Use it. But... there's just too many people here.
Way too many.
Yes.
Glad it's popular.
Totally. Cool. So, Edward, you are a chef. I saw you do a lot of styling. You are excel in pop-ups. How did this all start? Like how, and especially, you know, how did you find your way to New York? And yeah, tell us just a little bit about how you got to where you are.
So I was born and raised in Lebanon.
Okay.
In a very, very small town on the beach. And I moved to America when I was 10 years old. My parents thought that we would have a brighter future here. So we moved to Boston. And then after moving to Boston, I went to the Culinary Institute of America. And after my third year, I got suspended for plagiarizing. So my parents were like, you either come home and work at a restaurant in Boston or do whatever you want, but we're not helping you out. So I was like, I'm going to try out New York. So I got my first job at Cork Buzz in Union Square, and I moved into an Airbnb, which is one of your fellow Heritage Radio members, Leyte Sue's apartment.
That's so crazy.
And I moved in with her, and I kind of started finding my way in New York. I worked at different restaurants. I worked for Danny Meyer for a while, who I love. I love Union Square hospitality. But eventually I started realizing that there's not enough Lebanese food in New York City.
Mm.
And it was definitely in demand. So I started working for a lady, her name is Pamela Morgan, on the Upper East Side. I was helping her out with her cookbook, and I started doing little private dinners for her and her friends. And I kind of realized that becoming a private chef slash catering was what I really enjoyed doing instead of working for a restaurant and not having a voice and not having a say in what you're making and not using the ingredients that I loved. So I decided to kind of start doing private catering.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I did a little bit of investigating on how to get word out there, and I started doing Yelp advertising and some Google advertising and lots of word of mouth as well, and were with Leyte's help on pop-ups. I got my name out there a little bit more, and it kind of just started going from there. But there's definitely not enough Lebanese food, I think, in New York City, I would say.
What did you think about making, and what were the dishes that you really wished to see people eat when you first started doing this, and how has that evolved?
Just like, to me, it was like, well, so when this is the funny thing. When I moved to America, and in our social study class, they were like, make something that has to do with your heritage.
Oh,
so
yeah. Like food, cultural heritage.
Yes,
day.
Yes, yes. And I made hummus. And nobody knew what hummus was at the time. And these two girls came up to the hummus, were like, what is this? It looks like poop. And no one would try it.
Oh, no.
So that was that.
It doesn't even look remotely like that.
I know. Hmm. And now here we are, like, right. I think like 15 years later, and hummus is in everybody's fridge. So I think like labneh was kind of something that I wanted to make and people to try. I mean, people really don't have enough Greek yogurt in their diet, which is a great way of like live bacteria and like just some easy dishes like rezajej, which is our like Lebanese dirty rice, fettes with like zucchini or eggplant, and finished off with the tahini yogurt sauce and some fried pita chips, just roasted cauliflower with tahini, you know, just like basic things, tabbouleh. You know, Americans eat tabbouleh is like a bulgur salad. It's actually a parsley salad with a tiny bit of bulgur. So it's that kind of stuff. And kibbeh, which is our meatball, and kafta, which is our also another type of meatball. And surprisingly, New Yorkers were loving the food. At first, they're like, what is this? Like, I don't know, it doesn't sound similar. And then eventually, they're open to tasting different things. And having different pop-ups really made it easier for me to make different foods and have people try it and be like, wow, this is great. We love this.
How did you learn to cook Lebanese food?
My exact question, Kim.
My grandma. Yeah, definitely my grandma. I spent a lot of time with her in the kitchen and my maid. My grandma lived like two floors under us, so I spent a lot of time with her in the kitchen. And she was one of those people that all she did was cook all day. Mm-hmm. It was like, what's the next meal? What are we doing next? What's for dinner? What's for breakfast? What's for lunch? And it was always planning ahead. And it was never for like 4 to 5 people. It was always 10 to 12 people. And she only had one arm. So it was really beautiful to watch her cook her way through the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And we actually had a maid because both my parents worked. So I also would spend time with her in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother taught her how to cook. So mm-hmm. I would spend a lot of time with her baking and cooking mm-hmm. as well. After school, I would do my homework in the kitchen and just watch her cook. And that's how I kind of picked it up. Mm-hmm. And then when we moved to America, like, I just went into the kitchen and started cooking. My parents were like, how do you know how to cook? And I was like, I don't know. It just came about. Yeah. And yeah, that's how it kind of took off. But my parents definitely did not want me to get into cooking. They wanted me to go to like business school and do economics. And then I was like, no, this is what I'm destined to do for sure.
Mm. Are there dishes that you make now that are based on your grandmother's recipes?
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
Like there's this like stuffed potato that she used to make that like not a lot of Lebanese people do, mm-hmm. but you core the potato and then you stuff it with ground lamb and pine nuts and onions. And
sounds really good.
It's so good. It's absolutely delicious. Mm. And there's like this cookie that she used to make. It's a biscuit au chocolat. It's like they call it a chocolate salami in Italy.
Oh, I've heard about the chocolate salami.
Yes, yes. And she used to make it a special way with a little extra salt and a little Grand Marnier. So definitely some recipes that have come all the way to New York.
Yeah.
But and when we were talking and setting up this time on the radio show together, you had previously had just been in Lebanon for the olive oil harvest. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? You still go back there and you still have family there.
Yes. I love going back. That's where I get all my inspiration. Mm. My grandmother unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but I still go back to get inspiration from different restaurants and what's happening over there. Mm. But I normally go back in the summer, but this was the first time I went back in November. Even though it was my busy season, but my grandfather's getting older and I really wanted to learn how to make olive oil like he does. So he has a beautiful olive land with 80 trees. Mm-hmm. And I went down there at the beginning of November. Even though it did not rain that much this summer, we were able to harvest some olives. And we harvested the olives and then we took them to the manufacturing. We made the olive oil. And then from the olive pits, we took it to this other man. His name is Mansour and he's like an 85-year-old man, and he makes olive soap from the olive pits.
Oh, wow.
And it was incredible. I mean, it's like in his backyard, and his son lives in San Diego, his daughter lives in Chicago, and he's in like rural Lebanon, and he's making soap in his backyard. And it was, I think that was probably the best part of the whole thing. Mm. Just to see that there was absolutely no food waste throughout that whole process. And just to see how the older generation is taking on this beautiful, like, I don't even know, like, because when people think about Lebanon, they don't think of olive oil. Like, when people think of olive oil, they think of Spain or Greece or Italy. But just to see how they were making it there and how much love and effort goes into it, it made me proud. Definitely made me proud, yeah.
Mm. And when you were cooking with your grandmother or observing her, like, I think sometimes what people can run into when they're like trying to kind of capture a family recipe is like a lot of grandmothers or older family members are like, oh, I just put a little bit of this in, or I just do it.
That's
like
how she is.
Right. And so I think it's like so beautiful that the younger generation really wants to take on these recipes and treasure them. But also it becomes a little bit difficult because that generation's concept of a quote unquote recipe is a little different from ours. So
definitely
that's something kind of you have to do via trial and error.
Yes.
Or okay.
There's her like orange blossom cake that she makes that I cannot get down. I can't. I just really, really can't. Cause she measured things with like the Turkish coffee cup. You know, that's how she measured everything. And I don't have her specific cup.
Right.
And
baking
so
is very
yeah. Specific. And baking is very specific. So that's definitely one thing that I cannot get down.
You're still trying though.
And I'm still trying. For sure. I am still trying. But
tell
I also
us about the cake.
Yeah.
It's just like an easy, simple cake, but she like folds in orange blossom syrup into it, and it's so sweet and delicious. It's like what we would just run downstairs and eat all the time.
Is it like a light, airy cake? Is it dense?
No, it's very light and airy. I would say it's like close to an angel cake, but a little bit denser than an angel cake. And like me and my sister, she hated Nutella. We would bring our Nutella with us and like smother it with Nutella.
Wait, who hated Nutella?
My grandmother. She was anti anything not Lebanese, basically. So she was definitely against the Nutella. But it's still so difficult to get it, but I will eventually get to it. And I'm very excited to get to that day to make that cake. Yeah.
Do you have any favorite go-to stores in New York to source some ingredients or places that you like to go for produce or that are inspiring or that?
Produce. I mean, I go to Union Square Market for mostly Union Square Market for produce or Williamsburg on the weekend. I do like to go to Sahadi's for sure, of course, and Damascus Bakery. Weirdly, I've been living here for 5 years and I have yet to make it to Bay Ridge. And everybody's like, what are you doing? You got to go down there. So I will eventually make it.
Let us know.
Yes, I will.
You got to make the pilgrimage to Tannerine.
Yeah. They tell me it's amazing over there. So I really do got to do it.
But I love Damascus also.
Yeah, I love Damascus.
I used to swim at the YMCA on Atlantic and I would go to Damascus and eat a potato pie before and then go swimming. Like after work as a snack.
That's great.
Microwave it for you.
Yeah, I know.
Put hot sauce on it.
Yeah. Where else do I get? Well, I do get a lot of my spices from Lebanon. Orange blossom, rose water, pomegranate, molasses. Okay. All that stuff I bring back.
You do have your source.
No, yeah, I do have my sources. Olive oil I bring back as well. I order my sweets fresh from Lebanon. They get shipped in 3 days. This is a big one. Yeah. Haleb is the name of the company. They've been open since 1881. They make the best baklava. Their shipping rate is $19. So it's nothing.
Internationally?
Yes.
However much you get.
Yes. And it's amazing. And what's great about baklava and all those Lebanese sweets is you can freeze it. So it won't go bad. So I order a lot of my sweets through them. And they have great pomegranate molasses as well and orange blossom. I'm trying to think where else I get a lot
of stuff. That's a helpful tip already.
Yeah. I do love H Mart. Like, love H Mart.
What are some transcultural H Mart hacks or tips for your cooking?
I do Asian cooking as well for photo shoots and stuff like that. I think H Mart is so cheap for what they've got. I mean, they have such a variety of everything. All the sauces and all the sesame seeds.
Excellent prepared foods.
Yeah. Also. Oh, yes, of course. And, like, I love their kimchi pancake mix. I think it's the best. It's, like, perfectly dense.
Like the house brand?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I should look into that.
And you just add some water and kimchi liquid and kimchi to it, and that's it.
Oh.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Noted.
Yeah. I would love to chat a little bit about the most recent pop-up you did, Tahini Ranch.
Oh, yes.
I kept seeing it, no pun intended, pop up all over, like, Instagram, and it was at Arcostratus.
Yes.
Okay.
Greenpoint place.
We love Paige.
Yes.
The best culinary bookstore in Greenpoint.
Oh, so cute.
It's the fantasy bookstore cafe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For sure.
So how did that idea start and what was kind of the menu like?
We clarified this earlier just before the show, by the way, listeners, that it's Tahini Ranch as in dressing. Not in my imagination, a ranch, like a dude ranch.
Oh, I was tahini. Always thinking dressing.
Yeah, okay. I love her. I love the way you think,
like,
though.
Sexy, queer, cowboy ranch with, like, Middle Eastern spices. That's where my brain goes.
Just like sesame seeds flung about.
Yeah, bearded tahini ranch.
Okay,
sorry, I'm taking us off track.
It's more like ranch dress because it was kind of like Lebanese Southern inspired.
Yes, okay. That was the whole thing. It was so I worked with Tommy Werner, who's from South Carolina, and we kind of like. That's how the Southern came into it. And we came up with the concept of Tahini Ranch. And we did a Southern Lebanese menu. And it was so fun. I live in Greenpoint, so Archestratus was a must. And I had never been there for a dinner party, and then I went for a dinner party, and I saw the way the bookstore was set up. Like, she had talked to me about it, but then I couldn't really visually see it. And then I went, and I was like, wow, this is beautiful, because it's so cozy in there at night. And you're just, like, sipping on wine, and you're in the middle of, like, all these books, and it's just so nice. So we had to do the dinner there. And then after that, it was a lot of recipe testing, and I think we tested the menu a good four times to really get it down. But we came, I thought the menu really came through.
How did you decide what would be the foods that would be complimentary?
So first we started with a pickle board, and pickling is huge in the South, and so it also is in Lebanon, so that was kind of how we started it off. We had to do like a hummus, of course, and then we did a pickled beet yogurt, and we did a pickled shrimp, and we did a pickled vegetable.
Oh, I love pickled shrimp.
Yeah, and then we did like a sweet almond, sweet with Aleppo pepper, so it kind of, that kind of came through with the different, with Southern. And then we went into our mains, which was a shawarma, make your own shawarma platter with a tahini ranch. And then we did a za'atar grits with a beautiful fish that we got from Greenpoint Lobster and Fish. Absolutely delicious. And some pickled peppers on top. And then in a side of carrots with green goddess sauce and popped sorghum. That was the first time I had ever worked with popped sorghum. Well, sorghum. That was really, I'd never heard of it before. So that was a really nice new grain to pick up, southern grain. So that was really nice. And then we finished it with a labneh ice cream, finished off with cherries cooked in Aperol.
Wow. I'm really sad I missed this. But yeah. Good ideas to brainstorm.
Both, yeah.
And what was the reception? Like, people were like, you know, they had some new flavors.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. I don't think people had tasted labneh ice cream before. Or lots of people had not tasted labneh before. And we also had labneh part of the pickled board as well. So it was nice to have it at the beginning and at the end. I'm a huge labneh fan.
How do you make your labneh?
Yeah.
What makes yours special?
Mine is special because I mean, I don't think it's that special, but I just I grate two garlic cloves and I put a whole lemon juice with yogurt and salt, non-fat Greek yogurt. I like to use Chobani, and I just mix it all together and then you strain it overnight. That's all it is. But the garlic and the lemon adds an extra like tanginess to it, and the garlic just makes it so powerful. And you can just spread it on toast with some like mushrooms and leeks, or like in the summertime, some tomatoes. It goes with everything. And then for the labneh ice cream, we tried to use homemade labneh, but it came out too dense. So I ended up using store-bought labneh for the ice cream, and that worked much better.
Which brand do you use?
There's only one brand.
The Armenian one?
It's like a
red
white
and green.
Yeah, white and green, exactly. The only one at Damascus. Yeah, I have
used it. Yes.
There's also some of that in my fridge right now.
There's also a good one that Oasis sells, that's in blue, that comes from Canada.
Oh, the Oasis? Yes.
Oh, I love know Oasis.
That one very well.
That comes from Canada.
Yeah.
And that one's great too.
Yeah. I just always get it like a little bit like in the tubs, like in their own container.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That, my stop before the train a lot of times. It's a classic. Williamsburg classic.
It's fantastic.
It's good, right?
Oh my God. It's so good. they're not Lebanese. They're Jordanian. But I mean, they do it very well. And I think it's so great for that price, for that location. Even though all that construction's happening right now, I'm like, don't move.
I know.
Don't
go away.
Wait, they make their own labneh?
No, they have this other brand. Oh, okay. But yeah, I guess they just
I zoned out for a minute and I was like, that Oasis?
No. But they make great food.
They do make great food.
Like delicious food. I think their falafels are the best.
Do you ever go to the one on McGinnis?
Yes. That
like
one.
The giant one?
That one's a block away from me. Yeah. So that one is definitely the one that I go to. But the one off the L is like, you know, when you've been out and you got to get a little sandwich. Exactly. That's right there.
Exactly. Oasis has fed 20 years of people living off the L train.
Yeah, they're probably like,
I know everyone who has a story of subsisting on the falafel.
They're like, what the hell is
I'm
going on now?
I'm scared. I'm really hope they don't close. I really, really hope they don't. With all the L shutting down, and that road has been blocked off for so long now. I'm just like, please stay there.
I think people know it, but we will definitely keep them in our minds.
I always get extra cabbage slaw in my sandwich. I like a pickle.
So good.
Well, I think the Oasis has to send us off today.
Is calling.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Edward, for coming on our show.
Thank you.
I can't wait to come to one of your pop-ups. Yes. And also, I saw you have some recipes on your website,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do. Lots and lots of recipes.
Okay.
I try to come out with a recipe every week or every other week.
Okay.
So definitely check those out.
Anything you're excited for folks to be making right now for the holidays or just in general because it's delicious, something for people to think about as we sign off?
I have a cumin carrot recipe coming out this week, and that's going to be, it's vegan, and it's really delicious.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
We'll check it out.
A fun little starter, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It was so much fun.
Thanks.
And we'll see you around.
Of course.
We'll be back on the airwaves next week for a recommended reading. This is Food Book Fair. Talk to you soon.
Ciao.
Recommended reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.